Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon.
How about now? Now? Yep? No? Maybe so? I can never tell because I hear my own voice echo anyway. Yeah? Okay. When as a teacher, I know I've said this before and then I don't get through what I've got, but when you run out of material, you start late. That's what you do. So we are here in class number 10. So we are going to, per the schedule, we are to be finishing up this section on the flood, and that is indeed my plan to do so today. I will tell you that there's a little bit less content than I had planned to present tonight, but we'll get to that in just a minute, and I'll tell you why. So where we were, where we've been, we talked about what was brought into the ark. Of course, Noah and his family. Total of 8 people, every sort of food that is eaten, and of course the animals, and we're not going to revisit how many of what and all that kind of stuff. Other than just this briefly, and I do feel I need to make a quick comment / clarification here. So we talked about how many animals, and it says between chapter 7 and chapter 8 we find some different details, but of the clean animals there were 7 pair. Of all clean, of the unclean, we don't really know. Is it a pair? We find in chapter 7, meaning a male and his mate. But then in chapter 8, it says 2 by 2, male and female. So it would seem to maybe be 4 of the unclean animals. We're not really sure. Doesn't really matter. But we're not really sure there. And of course, of the birds, it says 7 pairs of the birds of heaven. Now, the comment that I want to make here that apparently there were a couple people who took some exception to something I said on Sunday, and I just want to be clear about that. What I said on Sunday was that when we read this clean and unclean, what do we immediately think of? The law, right? The clean and unclean, you know, those that have a cloven hoof or those who have claws or non-cloven hoof. Those who chew the cud versus those who don't chew the cud, all that kind of stuff. But at the time of Noah, what was true about the law of Moses? I always tend to say those two backwards. And so at the time of Noah, what was true about the law of Moses? It didn't exist. That's right. Okay? So likely even when Moses was writing down this story about Noah, he said clean and unclean here to tell who clean and unclean? The Israelites, right? People who had the law, okay? He's explaining that to them. Now, so that's what I said on Sunday. The exception that a couple people had is they felt that I was saying that Noah did not know what was clean and what was unclean. Now, I believe Noah didn't know what was clean and unclean according to the law, but it is clear that God told Noah to take a certain number of these kind of animals and a lesser number of these kind of animals, and did Noah do that? Yes. Okay. So it's not that Noah didn't know how many to take 7 pairs and how many to take 1 or 2 pairs. That really isn't what I was trying to say. It's just that when we read clean and unclean, that may or may not have been exactly what Noah took. Yes, sir? Yeah, they weren't eating the animals, right? As far as we know. Okay? That is something that we did talk about here, and we'll bring up again just quickly here. Okay? So we talked about, was it really possible, and we looked at all the pictures of the ark and all that kind of stuff. So they're in the ark. We talked about just over a year. The flood started in the 600th year, second month, and 17th day of Noah's life. And God tells them, finally, go out from the ark. Now, they've been not floating for a good long time, right? They've been kind of marooned there. And we don't know, did they all go out at the same time, or did they go down a little bit? We don't really know. But at the end, God says, hey, it's done. You go, right? And he says, you go in the 600th year, second month, and 27th day. So 1 year, 10 days, almost exactly here, they are living in the ark. And then where we left off on Sunday is as soon as they get out of the ark here, Noah makes a sacrifice. We talked about it's the first mention of an altar. It's the first mention of a burnt offering. We always assume that the sacrifice that is made by Abel was burnt, but we don't know that, okay? I'm not saying it was or wasn't. We just don't know one way or the other, okay? And, of course, we talked about man, God's promise never to do it again, and he sets the rainbow in the cloud there. God covers the new rules then for Noah and for all of creation actually here. The animals are now food. It does seem to be that they were vegetarian before or didn't eat the animals, where he says, now you can eat of all flesh, okay? Except for, do not eat of flesh what? With the blood, with the life, okay? Again, there is no, interesting, and to Tom's point a minute ago, there doesn't seem to be any restriction about what animals they can or cannot eat like we find later in the law, right? For now, for you, all flesh is food. At least that's what it says there in the book of Genesis, okay? And again, we find here that along with that idea of the life being important in the blood, he immediately follows that up with, for a man's life created in the image of God is a life. So if you take a life, whether you are a man or a beast, the cost of taking that life is your own life, okay? So we find that here immediately as soon as they get off the boat. All right, so this is literally the screen we left off on. Noah gets off the boat and becomes a farmer. I don't know what he was before, but it says now he becomes a man of the soil. And one of his first crops is a vineyard, which he promptly harvests that vineyard and does what? Yeah, gets drunk. Okay. So, the big question here, and this has been debated for thousands of years, literally the first early church fathers that we would have writings right in the very first century argued about this, and rabbis before that. What really happens here? So, of course, we see Noah plants the vineyard. It doesn't say he harvests it, but he harvests it and presses it and does whatever he's got to do to turn those grapes into some kind of alcohol here, and he gets drunk. And then he is drunk and basically, for not to sound indelicate, from what we know, he passes out, right, in his tent, okay? So something goes down in the tent, and this is the part that has been hotly contested for thousands of years, even before the New Testament, actually. Jewish rabbis contested this, and we have writings all the way into, you know, close to Solomon's time about who, what this was, what this meant here. What we know is that Noah is naked, of whatever that means, okay? Ham comes in, and something happens. We'll talk more about that in a second. Then whatever happens, Ham goes and tells his brothers about it. And do they think what happened was good or bad? Well, I think it was bad, okay? So the brothers come in then and cover Noah's nakedness. Now, the reason that this is so hotly contested is because of what happens when Noah wakes up. As soon as Noah wakes up, what does it say he knew? Yeah, he knew Ham had done something, right? Okay? So as soon as he wakes up, he knows. Okay? And then he goes on to place this pretty terrible curse on Ham, and by Ham, it's Cain, which is Ham's descendants, right? Okay. Now, again, I'm not going to get into this. There is a huge debate about why wasn't Ham himself cursed? Is it because God had already blessed Noah and his sons and their wives as soon as they got off the boat? And so Noah could not countermand that blessing. He didn't have the authority, so he laid a curse on Ham's descendants. A lot of people will argue that Canaan here is not really Ham's descendant. He is the youngest son of Noah. And so it was really Canaan who went in and saw. I mean, there's all kinds of theories here about what happens. The more interesting part, and this is the part that's truly debated, is what really happened. It's almost inconceivable to me to think that a father who is 600 plus years old, right? 601 years plus however long it took to grow the vineyard and turn it into wine, that him and his sons, some of which were hundreds of years old themselves, right, that at some point in their growing up, there hadn't been some nudity at some point, right? It's almost inconceivable to me to think of that. It is a different culture, okay? A lot of things come up about, did Ham really walk in and just see his nakedness? A couple questions come up about that. One, if that's all that happened, how did Noah know? Right? How? I mean, if I was passed out, I mean, I don't know what it's like to be passed out drunk, but if I was just, I mean, I sleep deep, and I wouldn't know if someone came in. They could probably do all kinds of stuff to me, and I wouldn't know, let alone just look at me. Okay? So if all he did was see the nakedness here, how does Noah know? And again, if he walked in and just happened to see him naked, man, that's a pretty terrible curse. If that's all you did was accidentally walk into the tent at the wrong time. Okay? So there's a lot of people who believe that this is a phrase that very politely refers to some other kind of sexual sin. Anybody know why we might think that? Is there any textual reasons or links that we might think that? In the book of Leviticus, when it talks about that, you know, fathers are not to have sexual relations with their daughters or their sons, or sons are not supposed to have sexual relationships with their mothers or their aunts, when it talks about those things, does anybody know the language it uses? It says, don't do what to them? Don't uncover their nakedness. Which is the same exact phrase that is used here to say that Ham uncovered Noah's nakedness here. So because of that, there has been a long-standing belief that there is some kind of sexual sin here. Then comes in the question of course, it mentions Ham and it mentions Noah. Is there some kind of homosexual thing here? Most early rabbis, and in fact, most early church fathers didn't believe that. They believed that because of in Leviticus, it says, don't go into uncover your mother's nakedness, because that's whose nakedness? That's your father's nakedness, right? In other words, that sexual relationship with your father's wife, that doesn't belong to you. That belongs to your father. So there really seems to be the common belief here is that Ham goes in and has sexual relations with Noah's wife. Now, whether that's his actual mother or that's another woman, you know, we don't know, because we don't know anything about Noah's wife, right? Or about their mothers. All three of the boys could have had different mothers, especially at that time. We know that was more common. It also becomes a little more weird when you think about him going out and, you know, bragging to his brothers about it, right? I mean, I don't see that him going out and bragging to his brothers if he had somehow molested his own father. I don't know. It's really a bad deal all the way around. Whatever happened here, it was something bad. Hold on one second, Tom. I'll get to you. Now, does that mean that's necessarily what happened? The answer is no. Because the only reason actually this is contested, that there was some actual kind of sexual act here, is how do the brothers respond? Yeah, and in fact, it specifically talks about them taking the blanket, putting it over their shoulders, walking backwards, and even when they're walking backwards, it says they what? Yeah, they averted their eyes so they wouldn't see. Okay? Yes, and the covering, the counterpart of uncovering, exactly. That's right. So it really, that language seems to indicate that maybe it was just, you know, some kind of visual thing. And maybe it was no more than Noah was in there passed out, and Ham goes in and takes his covers off. And so Noah knows he's uncovered when he wakes up. I don't know. The point of this here is that something happened almost immediately as we get off the boat that wasn't supposed to happen. That's really the point here, okay? And I even hesitated about whether I should bring those other things up because it's kind of hokey. I'll get to you in one second. But I really wanted you to know that that is a very prevalent argument out there. You will definitely hear it. You'll read about it if you study this chapter and you read what other people write about it. You read any commentary in the world, they're going to bring up that idea that people contest what this uncovered his nakedness means here and the brothers then covering it. So I just wanted to let you know that that is going to be part of this. Tom, you were first. Okay. Okay. So he didn't react well in his drunken stupor. Whether he was asleep or not, he was still in a state of drunkenness. So that could be. Okay. Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, there's a ton of not detail here, right? Yes, ma'am. Oh, sure. True. That's right. That's right. And that was where my other comment was going. Her full comment, for those who didn't hear, was that, one, we don't really know how far. I say immediately because immediately in the Bible story, it could have been another 50 years. We don't really know. We're not given that time frame. There could have been more people at that point. But again, more to my comment here is, which echoes hers, is that even though God selected Noah based on he was righteous, we don't know about his sons, whether they were righteous or not. They were saved based on Noah's righteousness. But nonetheless, God selected these eight people who were more righteous than everybody else, and yet still, the first story we're told of, however many years passed, they get off the boat and it's one of sin. What lesson has man not learned? Yeah, to only follow after God, right? And that really is the core part of this story of when they get off, is that God initially started this whole thing in creation and gave man, at least that we know of, relatively little guidance about what they were supposed to do or not to do, and what happened. Man, it went bad, and really bad, right? Okay, so God decides we got to start over, starts over with Noah, and it's going to go really bad again quick, not to preview too much of what we're coming up, but now it's going to get so bad that instead of destroying everybody, God has to do what? He's got to scatter them, right? Okay, that story's coming very quickly here. So we really, one of the important things to take from this story, and the whole first part of the book of Genesis, actually, and I don't know if Paul or Ben covered this, but in this first part of the book of Genesis, we see mankind, at least mostly from what we know, left to decide things on his own, because in the garden, what choice did Adam make? Who did he think knew better? He thought, well, Eve. He thought Eve knew better, which he was right, by the way. The wife always knows better. I'm just going to say that. It's the truth. Okay? But, so, and I live like that every day, don't I? Yeah, that's right. I got no points for it, trust me. So, they made the choice that they knew better than God, okay? And that their choice was more important, what they wanted was more important than what God wanted for them. So we are going to see this story repeated a couple times here when without the proper guidance, without the right kind of rules in place, what happens to that relationship between man and God? It just doesn't work. Okay? Because man does not have, what did Solomon say? It is not in man to what? Direct his own steps. If you don't believe that, read the first 10 or so chapters, 15 chapters of the book of Genesis. Okay? So that is why, remember we said that an important thing to remember in all of these stories is how do they point us to first, who? Abraham, and second, to Christ. So when we see what happened pre-flood and even immediately after the flood, man without a template, man without, at least as far as we know, I'll say that again, without a law, some kind of guidance, does not know how to follow after God. So Abraham is going to come on the scene, and really when we get to Abraham, it's the first kind of hope that God is going to provide a solution for all of this. We see a very glimmer of a hope in the promise in Genesis chapter 3, but it's not even going to become close to understand how is God going to make that happen until we get to Abraham. And now in those promises to Abraham, he's going to link Abraham to what? To that initial seed, right? And it's an important thing that we understand that. In Genesis chapter 3, it was the seed of the woman. In several chapters in Genesis, the promises to Abraham are through your seed, all of the world will be blessed. Don't want to preview too much of that. We're going to talk about it a lot later. But just remember, all of these things are somehow pointing to the fact of how much man needs a special relationship with God, and he needs God to tell us how to live. Okay? All right. So, now that we've covered kind of the story of the ark and the spiritual implications of that, I do want to talk a little bit here about some things that are not necessarily modern, but definitely more true as we, as mankind and as society, as we learn more and science continues to grow. What is definitely the case about so many Christians today in their relationship to the Bible and science or secular belief? We have to find some way to do what? To make them mix. Yeah. And I think they do work together. I'm not saying that they don't, okay? But it's almost like we feel compelled that the only way we can convince someone to believe the Bible story is if what? Yeah, we find some kind of man answer that shows the Bible is correct, okay? So that's why we get into this discussion a lot about the flood. Was the flood a fact that happened, or is it just a myth that's being told? Now, of course, I'm going to tell you right off that if we are not going to count the Bible as a factual historical document, then there is absolutely no way that you can prove this one way or the other. Okay? I had planned on, you know, maybe even showing some clips of some of the ways that, you know, Mount St. Helens, for example, really taught us a ton of science about how things can be created in an extremely short time. There's a mini Grand Canyon that was created by Mount St. Helens in the period of 9 hours. That if you compared it to the Grand Canyon, the only difference is scale. And so people would say, well, that would have taken hundreds of thousands of years, and that tiny little river running through it is what did it. But we know that's not true because we lived through those events that made it happen. Okay? But when you look at those kind of things, I'm going to tell you that every shred of that evidence that we could pull, whether it's that or it's, you know, in the past 20 years there have been these super deep holes drilled on almost every continent, and the layers seem to match up time-wise all over the whole planet. There seems to be these deposits of things, and it doesn't matter what kind of evidence you find for that. There's going to be two viewpoints of that from a scientific viewpoint. Even things like, you know, we talk about finding on mountaintops. We find these fossils and stuff of sea creatures that live on the bottom, right? Well, how did they get all the way to the top of the mountain? Maybe the flood put them there, or maybe, if you believe the billions of years theory, right, the top of that mountain was once where? On the bottom of the ocean, and it took it that long to get up there. Could be. I don't know. Okay? Could be. So the interesting thing about that is when you talk about those things, most people are going to see what they want to see. Christians are just as guilty of that as anybody else. Okay. Now, is there enough evidence then to convict you one way or the other? The flood didn't happen, or it did? I'm going to tell you that it's likely it depends on your view. And unfortunately, at least in my experience, and if you read online and you do all kinds of study here, it's almost impossible in this case to be impartial. Because you're trying to do what? Either believe it or disprove it. I mean, that's the reason that you would do this comparison. And anybody who I've ever read who even in their own mind would try to say they went into this study of looking at the archaeological and the paleological and the crust evidence and all those kind of things with an open mind to see what it says, the problem is you just run into too many theories about one way or the other. Because when did all of this happen? Yeah, we weren't there, right? All of this happened 4,000 plus years on the shortest term, potentially a little bit longer, depending on how you think of some of the genealogies in the Bible, right? But at least 4,200 about it ends up years. It makes it impossible to prove anything. What happened 4,200 years ago? We just don't know, okay? Now, so I had planned on showing some videos and talking about some of that evidence, but I'm going to tell you what, there are literally tens of thousands of hours of videos and articles and things you can watch on both sides of the story. And I did find one little 8-minute video that I thought about showing, but it just, if you want to go look at some stories, even, you know, there was actually a great series called Back to the Beginning with, what's her name, that really famous reporter. She was in Gilmore Girls that one time. Whatever she said, I can't hear. So that that famous reporter did this entire 3-day series on, you know, are there proofs for the Bible? And, you know, as really a skeptic, she showed that some people believe that. This guy went down to the bottom of the Black Sea, and from the Black Sea can show that, you know, something happened there. And so you're just going to find literally tens of thousands of hours. I would encourage you to watch them or not, as you so choose. One of the things that I did want to talk about here, because this is one of the most common things that's brought up, is this idea, are there more stories? I mean, after all, surely if there was a worldwide flood that happened sometime after the Tower of Babel, where we know men were what? Scattered. Okay, or sometimes before the Tower of Babel, so that we know men, when they were scattered, would have taken with them whatever stories were up to the Tower of Babel, right? So surely wouldn't we think that there would be these stories in more than one culture? I mean, think about it. Even from a Hebrew, Christian, Western kind of thinking here, after all, Moses was 900 years after the flood. Okay, this was written down 900 years later. Depending, again, on how literal you take some genealogies, the flood roughly happened around 2350 B.C., and the story of Genesis and those kind of things were written toward the end of Moses' life, probably around 1450 B.C., plus or minus there. Okay, so the question comes up then, do other nations have this story? And actually, the truth is, yes, most all nations have some kind of flood story. We've found several, actually, ancient stories that have been found that are thousands of years old. And some, especially some of the more primitive cultures today, South America, some of the cultures in Central Africa even, that you know don't have a lot of technology still, those stories are carried on even today in verbal tradition. Okay, that definitely happens. So where do we find these flood stories? We actually find them on nearly every continent in all races. I had planned on, I even put a comment to myself here, show the webpage. I'm not going to take the time to do that here. Even just go to Wikipedia, of course, one of the most, I mean, whoever's editing that page, you're going to get their flavor, right? Just go to Wikipedia and look up list of flood myths. And there's about 300 listed there, okay? From China to Africa, North America, South America, literally every single continent is represented with some kind of humongous worldwide or everything that person knew flood story. Okay. Now, the most common of those that people like to talk about is this story called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And I know on Sunday Tom raised his hand as having heard of that. Has anybody else heard of that before? The Epic of Gilgamesh, Paul? Okay, so it's a couple people shaking your head here, yes. What is the Epic of Gilgamesh? One of the reasons that this is important is not because of Gilgamesh himself, to be honest with you. There's only a small section of the Epic of Gilgamesh that deals with the flood. Gilgamesh is a king in Sumeria, and because of some things that are going on, he seeks out this guy called Utnapishtim, who supposedly is the man who built an ark, and survived the flood. And because he survived the flood, he has been given the secret of immortality that he knows, and he is still alive several hundred years later after the end of the flood. So Gilgamesh hunts him down in order to gain the secret of immortality. Of course, there's several copies of this found. This happens to be one of the most complete tablets that contains, I believe it's tablet 10, I should have written that down, of about 15 tablets that make up the Epic of Gilgamesh. Only tablet 10 has that. I have the entire story here, but it doesn't tell me which tablet it is. But anyway, this is one of the most complete surviving ones. There have been several versions of this found, some in cuneiform, some even in a different version of cuneiform. The earliest that we have found this story being written down was about 1900 BC, which, by the way, is what? Compared to the Genesis story? Earlier, about 450 years earlier, in fact. This would have been written about the time that Joseph and the family were going where? Into Egypt, okay, is when this story would have been written, well before Moses, okay? And in this story, Gilgamesh is said to have lived around 2100 BC, about 200 years before the tablet finding. And in the story, the flood happened, depending on translation, somewhere between 200 and 300 or 400 years before that, so around 2500, which, not coincidentally, is about when the Bible says the flood happened. Okay. Now, the entire Epic of Gilgamesh, you can download. This is just the tablet that it is on, the story of Gilgamesh interacting with Utnapishtim here. I don't want to read that whole thing, so I searched quite a bit and I found this pretty good summary here. I want to go ahead and read it from my thing, but I tried to put it in big enough letters up there. You can follow along with me, okay? So Gilgamesh goes to this Ut. I'm not going to try to say his whole name the whole time. Gilgamesh goes to Ut and says, "Hey, how are you still alive?" He finds him and says, "Hey, I thought you were going to be this godlike creature, but you're a man just like me. How are you still alive? What happened? What's your story?" So Ut goes ahead and recounts how a great storm and flood was brought to the world by the god Enlil, who wanted to destroy all of mankind for the noise and confusion they brought to the world. Some versions say evil there, okay? But the god Ea forewarned Ut, advising him to build a ship in readiness and to load into it his treasures, his family, and the seeds of all living things, plants and animals. The rains came as promised, and the whole world was covered with water, killing everything except for Ut and that which was in his boat. Okay, the boat came to rest at the top of a mountain, Mount Nisir, where they waited for the waters to subside. In order to figure out if the waters subside, they released first a dove, and then a swallow, and then a raven three times. They released to check for dry land. And then when the bird does not come back, they figure out that it is close enough to dry land. So Ut gets out of the boat. They make sacrifices and libations. He makes sacrifices and gets drunk. And even though the first god who wanted to destroy everybody was angry that someone had survived, the other god who saved him blesses him, saves him from the other wrath. So his wife, and they are granted this everlasting life here. Okay. Sound similar to what you've heard? So I did want to, there actually, if you read through some of those details, it's pretty amazing, and we're going to go through this really, really quickly here, but it is pretty amazing, and I don't usually like to turn my back too much, but I'll just read these from the screen here, of the crazy comparisons between, on the left here, we would have, you know, the story of Genesis, and on the right, the story of Utnapishtim in the Epic of Gilgamesh. So, of course, the extent of the flood is global in both cases. The cause is because of man's wickedness or man's sins, or in some cases because man can't shut up. He just makes too much noise for Gilgamesh. Who's intended to die? Okay, all of mankind. It focuses on the one city that really draws the wrath of God, but then he decides to destroy all men in the Epic of Gilgamesh here. The sender is the god, or assembly of gods. The name of the hero is different, and there is no correlation between those names. Don't try to get that. The hero's character is saved because he finds favor in the eye of the god, or is righteous. How they found out, the god tells them directly. Genesis doesn't say in a dream. He just says God spoke to Moses. In the story of Gilgamesh, it's in a dream. They're both ordered to build a boat. Did the hero complain about it? Yes, in both stories. The height of the boat, several stories. In Genesis 3, in the story of Gilgamesh, it's a six-story boat. Both describe being built with many compartments inside. Both describe having one door. Both have at least one window. Specifically talks in both cases about sealing it outside and in with pitch. The shape of the boat, we have talked about, you know, rectangular, we think, but really just length and width. The dimensions that are given, very specific dimensions, by the way, it takes up about an acre and a half of land is the square in Gilgamesh. The passengers are, in Genesis, the one family. In Gilgamesh, it's his family, and there's a couple slaves that are saved. All species of animals are brought in both cases. The difference in the flood, Gilgamesh only mentions the rains. It doesn't mention anything about the water coming up from the land. Okay. The duration of the flood is different here. How the test to find dry land, they both release birds. In the other one, it's a raven and doves. In Gilgamesh, it's dove, swallow, and raven. So again, very, very similar here. The landing spot, they both land on a mountain. They call it different names. Oops. But it may even be that those two are the same range of mountains, just different peaks from what we know. Do they make a sacrifice after the flood? Yes. Are they blessed after the flood? Yes. It's an extremely parallel story. Okay? So, well, what does that mean? When we look at not only the Epic of Gilgamesh, but the fact that there are these stories all over the planet, and while the details may differ, either a little bit or a lot, it's true that in almost all of these stories, the core is the same. God or the gods, depending upon if it's monotheistic or polytheistic religion in that area, were angry with man. A flood is sent to destroy everybody, but some are rescued. In some of these stories, they're not rescued. They just are crafty enough to survive. Okay? There's always some combination of plants and animals saved in the boat with the people, and that remnant is the one that then starts over and repopulates the earth. Okay? Now, is that coincidence or is that evidence? Again, it's going to depend on your viewpoint, right? If you're coming from a biblical viewpoint, this definitely seems to be that it's awful lot of coincidental details that would happen, too much to just be coincidence, and the fact that it goes all over all the earth is true. I don't know. I'll get to you in a second, Tom. Let me finish this last slide here quickly. So especially when we talk about the Bible versus the Epic of Gilgamesh here, there's really just too many similarities to discount. No scholar will try to discount those similarities because they are both from the same part of the world too, right? That story originates from the same part of the world. Now, the Epic of Gilgamesh definitely was written down first. I put seems to here, but definitely was written down first. So everybody seems to think that the Bible story then, the story of Noah, must have pulled from the Epic of Gilgamesh, okay? But really, I guess I would say it seems to be more, do they both retell the same story? And then the answer comes down to which one is correct. And again, that's going to be influenced by the way you read these stories. There's just no way to get around it. All right, I know it rang, but Tom, I'll just have your last comment. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very few people will, to his point, very few people will completely discount that there was some kind of flood event. At least in all of these cultures. Now, it just depends on how skeptical you are. But I just wanted you to have that information. And I think Ben is up on Sunday. So I'll relinquish the pointer. Chapter 11. 10 and 11. Chapter 10 and 11 for Sunday.